The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. Today we are talking to James Snowdy, who has a very interesting story about how he started a million-dollar online business. And James is actually maybe the only person I have ever met in the Foreign Service who has actually done this and is here to tell us how it happened. So James, tell us about your story. How did you come up with this business?
Hi, good morning. I first came up with this business back in 2005 when I was a young infantry officer stationed down at Fort Benning. I bought a Jeep and I used that Jeep to go off post. And when I was off post, I'd go running. And then after running, I had no place really to sit down. So I designed a hammock that fit on top of the Jeep when you take the top off. And you stretch it across and you lay down on it. It's only about 47 inches wide. However, you can, you know, you put your head on one of the roll bars, put your legs up on the other roll bar, or you can fit two people with their legs over the windshield. So it works. You have a nice vantage point to sit up, read your book, hang out. And I saw that as something that might be marketable. It took me about 7 years to bring that from actual idea to market, just because I was being lazy and I didn't put forth any effort between being on active duty and a bunch of other things. So when I decided that I was going to try to bring it to market, I turned my basement into this mad laboratory where I was cutting, you know, trampoline material with a hot knife and getting headaches from all the fumes, and bought a sewing machine and sewed the straps onto it and did a bunch of tests. I threw a party one weekend, and before everybody came in, there was a sign and it said, you know, please go use this ladder, sit on top of my Jeep, and then fill out the survey, which had a bunch of questions on how you liked it, what you think it should cost, what you would pay for it, how comfortable it was, anything you'd add. So.
Nice.
Did a bunch of thank you.
Free research and development, right? Like, hey, come to the party.
Gotta do it.
Do a little R&D. Thanks.
And then I found a manufacturer. That was a considerable effort because in the Jeep demographic, people like stuff made in America. It was difficult to find someone to manufacture this in the United States, just given our lack of manufacturing capacity back in 2012. But I eventually found somebody. And we did a test run. We did about 100 units. And that was almost a disaster, but we can talk later about that. The Jeep that I had was the green with the tan Sahara top. It's fairly ubiquitous. I thought it was the snazziest looking Jeep. So I made the Jamek, which is what I call my invention. I made it tan. Well, when I tried to sell it, I had a lot of people asking me if it could be black. Well, my production run was in this tan color, and I wasn't about to do another one. So I had 100 units of tan Jamex in my warehouse, being my basement, and I didn't have anybody to purchase them. So I was about ready to fold and give it up because, you know, I was like, well, you know, I've already spent $3,000. Why spend another $3,000 on something if only, you know, a few people want black? My wife, Nadia, came up with a great idea. She's like, let's do the other production run, but make them pay for it. I was like, well, how am I going to do that? She said, have a pre-sale. That way you get a good gauge of who wants one. They put their money down and you've got money to spend on this next production run. So you're not laying it out. And, you know, tell them in advance it's going to take 2 months. So I did that. We sold 20 on the first day, which almost paid for the production run right there. So Nadia saved the company basically on the first day.
Nice.
And then obviously we ended up selling all of those.
Well, I want to go back a little bit because I think a lot of people at some point in their life, they come across an idea like, you know, it would be really cool if this kind of product was made, or I have an idea for this business, right? But I think most people, they never get past that point, right? And so what was it for you that you decided like, oh, it would be really cool to have something like this? And then you just went out and you made it, right? I mean, did you have any kind of like a business background? I mean, it sounds like you were in the military at the time. It just seems kind of, I feel like it's, there's an interesting story there. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that.
The story, I guess, is just that I like to make things better if I can. I'm a fan of, you know, improving my situation or being more comfortable or whatever. From a labor perspective, you know, throwing a hammock on top of my Jeep, I had one that was, you know, a net hammock, and I just cut it to fit the Wrangler back in 2005. And then I didn't actually make one that was specifically made for the Wrangler until 2012. So getting from, you know, no hammock to hammock was very simple, you know, in the very beginning. Making a prototype was a little more difficult because I had to figure out, you know, what would fit, what would universally fit, because there are three or four different overall models of Jeep Wrangler. So the Jamek will fit from 1987 all the way up to present. But as we get newer and newer Jeeps, that space up there gets smaller and smaller. And right before I did a rather large purchase order, I was testing it, and it was 24 inches wide. I'm sorry, it was 27 inches wide or something like that. But the opening on one model of Wrangler was only 24 inches, so it wouldn't have been a universal fit. So I elected to cut it down those extra 3 inches at the last minute. I mean, this was like a change I made right before they went to production. And, you know, that saved us a bunch of money because it fit more Wranglers. So the ability, I guess, to go in and make something universal fit, it's not going to be perfect for everything, but it'll work for everything, is a lot of research and development. And also, you know, last minute changes to production runs and things like that. I did not know this. You know, it's whenever you bring a new product to market, you're making a guess. That's why when I had the party and I asked people to tell me, you know, do you like this? Would you use this? Most of my friends don't have Jeeps. And again, it is very niche because there's only, I think they're only selling about 100,000 Wranglers a year in the United States. I mean, there's a couple million on the road, but it's a very small market. And it only fits one vehicle. Well, it might fit the new Ford Bronco, but I got to get one to test it first. So you don't know if it's going to work. And that's why you start off small and you keep your expenses down. I did all of this with a credit card. My initial outlays were under $4,000, and that included my 100 unit production run. So it was mostly, you know, I didn't spend money on things. I used my time instead of spending money. So I did things myself, which is good and bad because I'm not an expert in any of this stuff. I am not an MBA. I've made many mistakes that were very expensive, very, very expensive mistakes. But, you know, I've learned from that.
And in the process of making this product, James, did you get a patent for it?
And I
if you did, oh, good. So maybe you can talk to us a little bit about that process. It seems kind of daunting. Was it challenging to get a patent?
Yes.
Did it take a long time? Does it cost money?
Yes to all of those questions.
Oh dear. Tell us.
I have my patent file framed on a canvas print in my office. I'm looking at it right now because of all of those things. It was so expensive and time consuming, and I'm pretty proud of it. So I started 8 years ago filing this patent, and I got it passed in May of last year. So it took 7 years. Most of that is my fault, though, because I elected to go and do it myself for the first few years and didn't hire a pro. Because they said, hey, it's going to cost you $7,000 if you hire a pro. So instead of spending the money on the outset, I did it myself, which, you know, I'm not an attorney. As we spoke earlier, I was an English major. I don't know anything about how any of this works. So it took me multiple years, and I ended up spending the $7,000 anyways. So during that time, I lost out on some sales because I didn't have a patent. People in different areas made copycat products of mine and sold them on Amazon, skirting, you know, patent law through different ways. And I wasted time. However, in, you know, eight years ago was what, 2013, I didn't know how much money I was going to make on this. So I didn't know if $7,000 was going to be a good investment or poor investment to get a patent. So you have to weigh those things. If you're very small business, though, you can use something called the micro entity filing. And that's only a couple hundred dollars to file the patent. And then instead of getting a patent attorney, if you get a patent agent, that is going to cut your costs in about half of what they would normally be. So, you know, just food for thought. There's also a really good website called Upwork, where you can find people that are very knowledgeable in patent law, and they can fill in some gaps if you need them at an hourly rate, or they can do the whole thing for you. I had my logo made on Upwork by a gentleman in London, and it cost me like $175, the logo is great. I love it. And it's mine now. I bought the copyright, and I got it copyrighted using labor on Upwork. That also only cost me, I think, maybe $200 or $300. So we did, you know, we have this intellectual property now.
I think this is a good time to segue into how you run this business. So you just mentioned that you use a lot of online vendors and sort of freelance websites. So how are you doing that exactly? So you have a day job, right? And I can imagine it can be, you know, busy. It has its own demands at times. And especially when you're working like 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 or whatever, like how do you manage this business outside of that?
So I've got it to the point where a lot of it runs itself. There are certain things that I still have to do, you know, monitor my inventory levels, purchase products, invoice, and cash checks. I don't do as much marketing as I used to because we already have a pretty good client base and our word of mouth. And I have 6 or 7 regional distributors throughout the United States that sell in various regional markets. We have one national distributor that used to buy a bunch, but doesn't buy so many anymore. So from a management perspective, I did a lot of the hard work early on, and there's not a lot left because I like things to be efficient, and I like things to be automated. So I've tried to automate as much as I can and eliminate as much wasted time as I can as well. So, you know, I don't do fulfillment. The factory makes them, they ship them to the warehouse. The warehouse is tied into my website, which uses Shopify. I don't host it. When someone makes an order, the order goes directly to the warehouse. They fill it, and then they just bill me, which they have my credit card, and they charge that. I have one credit card that I use for all JAMIC issues, which helps when it comes to IRS time. And that was super helpful last year because I got audited by the IRS for 3 years of my business income. And they said I owed them in the six-figure range, about $110,000 because Whoa. They didn't realize that my business has expenses and they thought that all of my revenues were profit. So
silly IRS.
It was a nightmare. I had to spend thousands of dollars on representation for my audit, and I ended up winning. The IRS actually owed me $4,000. I did not owe them anything because I didn't cheat on my taxes. So it was just a nightmare situation because I was overseas calling my IRS guy, you know, like 3 times a week, working with a CPA. And the IRS apparently doesn't allow you to mail anything. You have to fax it because they live in 1994. So it was very difficult, but, you know, now I'm a better person for it.
Oh my goodness. I love your story, James, because I think for all entrepreneurs and all business people, there is at their core a sense of just determination and sheer will, because none of what you're describing here sounds very easy. None of it, right? I mean, sure, it sounds great to say, oh, I have $1 million online business now, right? But a lot of times people just see that and they don't see everything, you know, that came before it, all of the, you know, nights in your basement with, you know, the smelly chemicals trying to make something, or fighting with the IRS about this, or, you know, just trying to get a patent and like trying to figure it out all yourself. So, I mean, bravo to you, because I don't think I would have made it that far. I would have been like, oh my gosh, anything administrative, I would have just been like, oh my God, this paperwork is going to drive me crazy. I can't do it. But I'm curious, like where do you go now with this business? So you have it to a point where you're automated and you can essentially kind of take it overseas, right? Or wherever you go, it's kind of portable. Do you plan to blow up the sales and marketing at some point? Do you plan, do you have any employees? What's kind of the future for this business?
So we do, all of our employees are on a contract basis. We have we had sales reps, four at the time that covered one region of the United States and then one international. A lot of those folks fell off because either they retired or they just wanted to go someplace else. They all work for different larger sales organizations, and we were one of their accounts. Right now we have two sales reps that deal with the Northeast and the South, which are, you know, two of our bigger markets. I used to employ a social media professional, and she was great. She grew our Twitter, by a couple thousand followers, did Facebook and, you know, other assorted branding things where she'd get us into magazines or, you know, lots of actually really cool stuff that I hadn't thought of. But she was very expensive. She was about $1,000 a month. And, you know, we were an account of hers. She was not a full-time employee. She did this because she was really good at it. So we contracted with her for about a year, maybe a little more. And then I left because I think our sales had dropped a bunch, and I couldn't afford her anymore because she was so good. I couldn't afford to pay what she was worth. So right now, like, social media has just been really slow because the sales have been good. So I haven't seen a need to push it. But as far as expanding, you know, sure, who wouldn't want to get, you know, grow and get bigger? We've stabilized. We sell between 1,000 and 3,000 units a year, 3,000 being our best year, an average year being, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 or 2,000, I would say. This year, we're on track to sell about 3,000. I think that coming out of COVID, people are going to want to go out and do stuff. They're going to want to get on the trail. And so I think people are getting ready for that. But because of COVID, we were sold out from March all the way through until November. And then I had to fill 500 back orders, and we sold out over Christmas. And then I had 500 more back orders that I had to fill this month, which all just went out. And we're still doing back orders right now because the demand is pretty high. So, you know, I would love to, you know, blow it up or to have, you know, somebody make me an offer and buy the business wholesale. There was, for many years, I attempted to get Jeep, the company, to take notice and offer this as an option. You know, how do you do that? I don't live in Detroit. I don't know anybody in that works for Daimler Chrysler. So I found the president of Jeep's home address, and I mailed him a press kit with a unit. And I said, "Hi, unsolicited stuff here. Here's a bunch of pictures of what my product does, and here's one. I assume you know someone who owns a Jeep." Now, if I was the
so
president
cheeky.
Of Jeep, I know, right? If I was the president of Jeep, I would have been like, "Oh, okay, this kid's got moxie, kid." You know, and I might have given that guy a call and been like, "Hey, you know, we don't want this, but you know, good for you." I got no response, and I'm used to that because I'm a salesman at heart. And a lot of, you know, most of your sales leads don't pan out anyways. So I ended up finding out that I guess a lot of these big auto companies, you know, they don't want your idea for their option or their standard equipment. They want to use their own stuff, and they're not going to buy it from you unless it's like really good and this isn't. So, you know, I tried, and I think I'm going to stop with that line of attack.
No, but it's very interesting to hear that. It makes sense, right? I mean, in that case, it might be more interesting for them to buy you out. Have you had offers to buy your business?
No, but I would, you know, if someone wanted to, and if it was the right number, then absolutely, sure.
There you have it, foreign service listeners. So tell us too about, so you actually have a second business as well. How did this second business come about?
So when my friend and I, John, we used to carpool to work when we were in Europe. He was our GSO and a really smart and funny guy. And as I've already mentioned, my wife, Nadia, is really smart and also funny. We found a need for funny t-shirts or funny clothes or diplomatically themed something. coming from the Army as I do, the Army has a great sense of heraldry. They have symbols for everything. They have a tradition. They have a history. And then I don't know if you have noticed this, but there are about a million Vet Bro t-shirt companies out there selling everything from, you know, infantry related things to guns and all that stuff. I didn't want to Vet Bro the State Department, but there is definitely a need for, or at least I thought, something like that. And at the very least, something funny and also something that might be a little morale boosting, because the only real State Department stuff that we have are at the Farrah Foggy Bottom stores, where you can buy something with the seal on it, or, you know,
your mug or.
Yeah. That's okay. That's great. And here you go. That's a serious gift. But, you know, we have funnier things, and we have stuff that, in my opinion, I wanted it so that people would ask a question of the wearer or the user of it. Because as you both know, we don't have much of a constituency inside the United States. The people that we serve barely know what we do or that we exist. And if someone that you see is asking, well, hey, what does your shirt mean? You can tell them and start a conversation about why I'm wearing the shirt, what I do for the United States, and what my value is to you as both a citizen and a taxpayer and all of that. So anyways, as I was mentioning earlier, my wife, Nadia, my friend, John, we'd be in the car. We would come up with these ideas, and it all started off as like this, you know, just funny thing to do. We're going to have an idea for a t-shirt. Ha ha ha. And then I was like, you know what? For $29 a month, I can put this on Shopify. And if it only costs me $29 a month, I have this platform and we can, you know, put our silly fun things on there. And if it sells something, great. I had a shirt. It was gorgeous. So they have some shirts on there that are all over print, right? They do the whole thing. It's not just the front or the back or the sleeves. I took high definition photos of the Drexel Heritage mustard colored couch and I put them on a shirt, and we sold a bunch, but then the vendor that made those specific shirts went out of business, and they didn't have it anymore for a while. So it's been out of stock. I really need to go back in though and turn that back on.
No, there are some really fun things in your store. I was dying. I was like, oh my, okay. So people, you can go on James's website and see if you want a giant fleece blanket that it looks like the cover sheet for, you know, the Top Secret stuff. They have that. I actually like the women's shirt that says persona non grata on it. That's nice too. So definitely yes, check his store out. It's fun.
That one started as a gift for a good friend.
I have some friends I could actually send it to, unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not sure, but. So James, I'm curious, you know, you have these two businesses and you're also currently working right now. There are, you know, ethics concerns and then different offices that you need to loop in to make sure you're on the right side of things while you're doing these sort of after hours activities. So how do you make sure that you're on the right side of the regulations, and what kind of advice would you have for people who want to do something similar?
The first thing I did before I came over to State Department was I ran JAMIC up the flagpole to L, and they gave me their opinion, and I still have it to this day. It hasn't changed. Their opinion is that when you're overseas, you need chief of mission approval to do it, which I have gotten at my posts. Burn bag gear came when I was in the United States. We thought it up in Europe, and I started it when I got back to the United States on a domestic tour. I went back to L, and they said, what are you asking us for? You're in the United States. As long as this isn't going to embarrass the State Department, you're fine. So those are the two legal opinions that I have. I recommend that anybody who does want to start a business or have outside income, I recommend that you go through L and get your own legal opinion. But that's what mine were.
And I think that's important too, because I think a lot of our colleagues might think of something like this and then get worried that maybe, you know, the powers that be are going to say, oh, you can't do that. And so the process is actually not as bad as people think it is. And there's a lot of things that you can do. I think the culture is just very conservative in a sense. And, you know, comparing it to military, as you were doing earlier, I mean, there's so many things that the military does that we don't do. And of course we're different, sure, right? But even like starting this podcast, I think there was a little bit of like, what is this? And, you know, there's a long history of podcasts for military members about personal finance. So this isn't anything new. I think it's just, you know, part of the culture is conservative and there is a way forward, right?
I was told by a couple of people, oh, you're going to have to divest when you go overseas. You're going to have to do this. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like I've read the FAM. It doesn't say anything like that. And yes, the ethics concerns are such that it, the only real thing I wasn't able to do was do business in the country to which I was accredited. So
makes sense.
Fine. And that's fair. But you know, that was it. I've also had very understanding bosses. You know, just don't do work on company time and don't sell in the country to which you're accredited.
So in that case, James, when you go overseas to a certain country, do you just remove that country from the list of places you ship to?
Yeah. And it'll say there, it'll say does not ship to X.
Oh, interesting. And where in the world do you ship to? Everywhere? I mean, I'm sure there's certain places you don't, but.
We recently stopped doing international sales just because customs was and duties were so high.
It's a nightmare.
$50 or $60 to get a unit to Canada. And it should not cost that much to get to Canada. So we just made it easier and stopped it altogether. It's cut a bunch of sales, but it's been less of a hassle.
And I feel like Jeep is very American anyway, right? I mean, I don't know how many Jeeps are sold overseas, but the main market, it sounds like it would be domestic.
It is. Canada has about 10% the amount of Jeeps sold per year as the United States. But we've sold a bunch in like Bahrain, Saudi, Italy, Switzerland. There's some market out there. It's not huge, and again, it just wasn't worth the hassle. Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're kind of at the, I don't want to say at the end, but you're on the other side of like, you know, starting an idea and then developing that idea, getting a tangible product, bringing it to market, going through sort of the travails of a business person. And you're kind of on the other side of that process, right? So that now you have a system where it's automated. And I'm curious about how much time does this take out of your week to run this business at this current point? And actually it's two businesses, right? Technically.
So for Jamic, I'm at the point now where I'm just doing accounting and cashing checks. Accounting and accounts payable are surprisingly time consuming because I'm automatic, but my vendors are not. So I want them to pay me via PayPal. A lot of these folks send checks and they send them 2 months after we do the sale. Ooh. Or they will tell me, oh yeah, just charge the credit card when it ships to me. So you have to go back, check, and make sure it ships to them. And you have to make sure that the credit card is right. And then the invoice is correct. So, you know, I just recently got paid, but I had like $30,000 in outstanding invoices and accounts payable. Mm-hmm. So it takes a while sometimes for that. So as far as how much time do I spend, I don't know, an hour a week, it's really not that bad. During the audit, I was up, you know, 6 p.m. to midnight every day. I had to pull $500,000 worth of receipts.
Wow.
And I mean, it was very, very difficult. So there's that. There's always that possibility too. Jamic is structured under an LLC. So we have some, you know, limited liability protections. However, those don't extend to audits. You still have to run through the audit if the IRS comes knocking. So one of the things that I think a lot of people gloss over is when your business starts to do well and you start actually making money, you got to make sure that you've compartmentalized that money so that you're not intermingling funds with your house funds. So you know what your expenses are. So if the IRS does come around, you know, you're not sitting there like I was, because there was some stuff that I had intermingled and I'm like, oh no, I can't claim this. I can't claim that. There was a portion of my audit where I missed $40,000 worth of income, but I'd also missed $40,000 worth of expenses just because I hadn't had my accounting as tight as it should be. And, you know, as we spoke earlier, English major here, not a math major, not an accounting major. So certainly not an MBA. So a lot of the accounting was just a spreadsheet I had on Google Documents that is now like 4,000 lines long of expenses and sales and all that stuff.
So you still run your business on Google Docs? Like,
oh yeah.
Wow. So you don't have a bookkeeper or a CPA or anything specifically for the business?
I have a company in Northern Virginia called Aiken and Company, who they are my CPA now. They're relatively new. I've had them for the last 2 years, and they're the ones that conducted my audit and saved my financial life. And they get it at the end of the year. During the year, I'm the one that keeps track of everything, and then I compile it all and send it to them, and then they run the figures, and they do me and Nadia's personal taxes in addition to the books, the final numbers for JAMIC for taxes. But no, I'm the bookkeeper for now. It can also be like, hey, I'm gonna go down to Jeep Beach Week in Daytona for the weekend, and you know, sit in a booth for 12 hours a day selling JAMICs. I haven't done that in forever, but those are opportunities that you can take as well. So, you know, I've actually missed out on a lot of those opportunities because I've been overseas and I've had to pay somebody else or miss it entirely to go do it. But my philosophy a lot of the time is to, you know, throw money at like an absentee father and have that fix, you know, what I can't.
Yeah, but you're not an absentee father. And in fact, you sent us a bio that talked about the other kinds of things that you like to do in your life. And, you know, we believe on this podcast that wealth can encompass all different types of things, not just money.
I do. Yeah. Alex just turned 6. He loves the JAMIC whenever, you know, his mom is from Puerto Rico. So whenever we go down there, we rent a Jeep and we bring a JAMIC so we can throw it on top of there. And I take the opportunity to take some photos, you know, for our own posterity and also for our social media, because Alex is a cute kid. And he's little, so the JAMIC looks a lot bigger when he's laying down on it. And, you know, my wife also, when we first started going, she was the official JAMIC model. So, you know, when you have good folks to help you out, and they're free, like, you know, when you use that. We also had, you know, a couple of my friends, Kevin and Gina, our photographers, and this was back many years ago. They did our first, you know, big photo shoot. We went down to Lake Accotink in Virginia and parked the Jeep in front of the lake and took a bunch of pictures and you know, did the kids playing frisbee and flannel behind it to make it look, you know, bucolic. And there it was. So, you know, I'm losing my thread here. My son, Alex, he and I are best pals. And no, I'm definitely not an absentee dad.
And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is the other interesting thing from your bio that I thought was just amazing. Considering you already have your job and then you have these two businesses, I was amazed to find that you also run 1,000 miles a year, no exceptions, sometimes with your son, your 6-year-old, accompanying you on his bike.
Yeah, we did the CNO Canal last year. I ran next to him he did 10 miles on his bike. And he did such a good job. And then recently he and I ran a 5K. We live in Pentagon City now. We went down to a 4-mile run and back, which is about 5K. And he ran one of those. He loves running. He loves biking. We call it BRUNK, BRUNKE. That's a portmanteau of bike and run. And of course the U has umlauts because it has to be metal. So so we do that, and whenever I do a BRUNK, I put it on my Strava feed, like that. So, and a lot of kids don't like running. For him, it's all about, do you feel like doing it? And if you don't, we're not going to do it today. And I'm not going to push you. If you want to walk, we're going to walk. I want to try to make this as fun as possible because, in my opinion, you know, I ran track and cross country in high school, and then I took like 10 years off for college because I was a lazy layabout. And I think that it builds good habits, you know, for kids when they, as they get older, it keeps you in good shape. And if he views it as a fun thing more than a work thing, I think it'll stick more. I have a lot of help. You know, Nadia is good at lots of these things too. And, you know, she shoulders half the burden for all this stuff as well. Not that Alex is a burden, but he helps me too, right? Because like ordinarily I'd be out by myself running and then I'd come back and you know, he would be with Nadia and she'd be taking care of him. So if I'm out with him, then we not only get, you know, some quality time together, I get to do what I need to do and he gets to work out a little bit too. So, you know, when COVID hit too, especially like I was like looking for things to do. I mean, you know, we have a national park pass now. I got him a hiking stick and, you know, we went and did the Billy Goat Trail up at Great Falls, Maryland side, and he climbed the giant, you know, cliff face and all that stuff. It wasn't dangerous. It's the 45 degree angle one, not the, I would not put my, he was five at the time, not put my 5 year old on a real cliff face. But, you know, we like to do these things together. And as a family, we like doing a lot of outdoorsy stuff. Nadia is a runner as well. And she gets out there with us from time to time too. So, you know, from a time management perspective, like a former infantry officer here, you have, you know, very little time to do very many things. So one of the, we have these things called the troop leading procedures, or at least we used to back in my day. And there's 8 of them. My favorite one, I know this is like the nerdiest thing ever, is what's your favorite troop leading procedure? Mine is, it's called start necessary movement. And that's anything you can put into motion while you're waiting for other stuff to get done, you should do. So it's almost like things off of the critical path in project management, which I also used to do for DOD before I became an FSO. So anything you get started, get the ball rolling, and anything you can delegate, you delegate it. And a lot of these little techniques that I've learned over the years, they add up. If you can make time on the margins, and you can save so much time and do so much more. The other side of this is I don't go to bed before 1 a.m. On most nights. Last night was even later. And you know, cause you can spend as much or as little time as you want on certain things. Sometimes like I stay up late because I like to read. And if I'm doing stuff during the day, like I never read during the day because that's when Alessandro is awake and, you know, I'm usually with him unless he's in school. So I read at night. I'll read my fiction or my nonfiction or whatever else, professional development stuff. So, you know, if you're willing to sacrifice, I guess, a little bit of sleep time, and also find time in the margins to do stuff, you can make time for the things that you need. Thank you, Tanya, very much for having me on the podcast. And I want to thank both of you for the service you're providing for the community. So I know that there's, you know, everybody has money issues and there's always a better way to be able to do something. And if somebody can benefit from my very, very, very expensive mistakes in the past and not make them, like, for instance, paying $12,000 for what essentially was a landing page for a website that I could have made for, you know, an hour online, you know, I want to be able to help people avoid that.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.